Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. It's always good to have you along, and we're looking forward to today, especially as we bring back a friend to the broadcast who's been on several times, and so appreciate his great insight and information, because today is in the midst of Holy Week, what's called Maundy Thursday. It's also just a day before Passover begins tomorrow night, and very frequently Passover and Holy Week are sort of in the same neighborhood, so we're going to talk a little bit about that coming up in a moment. Ted, do want to mention, though, that we, April, just launched our new Bible study giveaway. We've got a copy of the NIV First Century Study Bible that we're giving away, so which is a great opportunity to experience the Bible through the eyes of a first century disciple.
I think I saw that on your desk, pretty thick.
Yeah, oh, it's solid, and got some great pictures and great insights. So I know that you can sign up for that online at myfaithradio.com. We give one of those away each month. And so that's our Bible study giveaway for this month. But we have a special giveaway today as well. Our guest today, Dr. Michael Redelnik, is a professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute, and he's written several books. He's a noted Bible scholar specializing in the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish people, the land of Israel, biblical prophecy. And he is also one of the co-editors of the Moody Bible Commentary, which is a one-volume commentary in the whole Bible. And it's basically, you know, from A to Z, a couple thousand pages. I'm not sure what if we would ask the weight of the book, Ted, I'm not sure what we'd, you know, we're in there. It's a five-pound book at least. But, I mean, this would be a great resource. We're going to give it away today.
Great.
But it'd be something, you know, it would help you in your understanding, your walk of faith, and maybe even as something you'd like to give to a gift, perhaps someone who's finishing up a confirmation, or it's someone who is maybe new to the faith, even perhaps this week. So sign up for that. You can do that. We're going to do a drawing at the end of the show. So if you want to call right now to get in on that, to give us a call at 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. Let me introduce Dr. Michael Redelnik back to the show, professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute. He's a sought-after speaker and teacher. He's written several books, including Understanding the Arab-Israeli Conflict, what the headlines haven't told you. Mentioned that he was the co-editor of the Moody Bible Commentary, and he's also been on the translation team for the New Holman CSB version of the Bible, and we're honored to have him with us today. Michael, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you. I don't know what happened there for a minute, but I'm glad to be back.
We are connected, so we appreciate that. It's radio. There's always the mystery, I guess.
I know. I have a radio show on Moody Radio called Open Line.
That's Saturday mornings, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's on your station, is it not?
It is not, no. But but now, of course, you've added the pressure. So,
So
thank you for that. Very, very subtle, but very effective.
I didn't mean to do that, but the very first week I ever did it was just local in Chicago at the time, my radio went off. My phone, my iPhone started playing music. I don't know why. I finally threw it out of the studio, and the producer said to me, "Michael, that's welcome to live radio.
Sure.
Things go off you don't expect." So,
well, we're hoping for a more dignified or normal hour, I guess, here this hour, but maybe just fun. But now Passover comes; it actually begins tomorrow night. Is that right?
Yes, Friday night.
And is it always near or around our calendar celebration of Easter?
Yeah, it's usually around it, but it's not always on the same. In fact, for the first few centuries, right up until the 4th century, the church celebrated Easter, the Easter week, and the resurrection of the Messiah, I would say, the recognition of the Messiah's atonement for us, the crucifixion and his resurrection. It was celebrated as part of Passover. In fact, in Italian, the word for Easter is Pasqua, Passover. Yeah. And then in the 4th century, Constantine at the Council of Nicaea, he was like, no, we want to separate, and it was rather hateful of Jewish people. We want to separate from the company of the Jews, so we're not going to celebrate it as part of Passover anymore. And so they came up with sort of like this spring equinox kind of cycle for the celebration of Easter. But because they're both spring holidays, they sometimes are on the same weekend, sometimes not. But they're usually close to each other.
And is this as significant a holiday for a Jewish person as any in the Jewish calendar?
Yeah, studies have been shown that many Jewish people are quite secular here in the United States. Jewish people generally are not, I mean, they identify ethnically and culturally, and but just like most nominal Christians in America go to church, you know, on Christmas and Easter. Jewish people tend to celebrate Hanukkah and Passover, and the Passover Seder is the single most observed holiday or celebration of Jewish people in the United States.
How would the Passover, maybe a current version of the Passover, compare to what it would have been early on, or at least at the time of Jesus? And give a little history. Obviously, it goes back to Egypt, right?
Well, yeah, there was always some sort of celebration of Passover. It was required in the Book of Exodus. Sometimes people neglected doing it, but there was a celebration. It was the Passover lamb was sacrificed, and there was a memorial. They ate bitter herbs with it and matzah. As time went by, we can see there's a section of rabbinic literature in the Mishnah that lays out how it is that Passover should be observed. And that was written down in book form, so to speak, in the end of the 2nd century AD, so about 200 years or 170 years after the events of the Last Supper. So people say, well, then that can't give you good background because it's later. But those were oral traditions that were in vogue for centuries before they were written down. So if you look at the Mishnah, which is that kind of rabbinic literature, and see how Judaism was celebrated, how it celebrated Passover, it gives you a great background for the Last Supper. And, you know, the idea of the four cups, the idea of the entire service revolving around a certain plate where there's bitter herbs and there's salt water to represent tears. All those things that are there are really found in the background of the Mishnah, and Jesus really did observe a Seder, much like all Jewish people did in the first century, and very many Jewish people still have a lot of those traditions today.
You mentioned the four cups, the plates, the salt water, the bitter. I mean, is everything symbolic in Passover? And a Seder, that's the word you use, right?
A Seder means service or order.
Okay.
And, it's there are so many symbolic things on that Passover plate. There's green, like parsley, that represents life. You know, we dip our lives then in salt water, which represents tears. When we were slaves in Egypt, our lives were filled with tears. We eat the horseradish to bring tears to our eyes, to remember the bitterness of slavery. And of course, believers today, we can think of back to our lives before we knew the Lord, when we were slaves of sin. Our lives were filled with tears, and he's the one that brought sweetness to our lives. The Messiah did. And of course, there's a bone, lamb bone, to remember the Passover lamb. Of course, we could remember the pure and spotless lamb, the Messiah, Jesus Messiah, our Passover. So there's a lot of symbols there on the Passover plate, and they really work well with a follower of Jesus who can see those symbols not only for what their traditional meaning is, but also as a follower of Jesus, how it's symbolic for what he has done for us.
We're going to take a break now and then come back and dive more into the Passover and get particularly perspective on that Passover meal where Jesus gathered his disciples. And it was in the upper room, and we've got a famous painting about that. We'll get Michael Rodelnik's perspective on the painting, and then more about how Jesus used that Passover to communicate some important truth then and for us today. Dr. Michael Rodelnik is professor of Jewish studies at the Moody Bible Institute, and by the way, of one of the things that he has done. He is the one of the general editors for the Moody Bible Commentary, and we're going to give that away today. If you'd like to register for that, we'll do a drawing at the end of the show. Sign up at 877-933-2484. 877-93-FAITH to enter the drawing for the Moody Bible Commentary. And more on the Passover and Maundy Thursday. We'll find out about what that means. Dr. Michael Rodelnik coming up.
He's dying tomorrow. The hand that is breaking the bread soon will be broken. And here at the table sit those who've loved him. One is a traitor and one will deny. Though he's lived his life for them all and for all be crucified.
Michael Card and Come to the Table, and we're talking about this table. We call it the Last Supper, and it is that gathering in the upper room with Jesus and the disciples. We're talking about it today on this Monday, Thursday of Holy Week. We'll get some perspective on what the Monday, Thursday means and talk about that supper more as we reflect on the Passover celebration and reflection. Dr. Michael Redelnik is helping us out with that. He's professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute, sought-after speaker and a teacher, biblical scholar specializing in the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish people, the land of Israel, biblical prophecy. We always love talking with. What's wrong with that picture?
Leonardo did that painting, and, you know, it's obviously a great work of art, but, you know, it's filled with his biases. So there's so many things that are wrong. There's a beautiful platter of fish, you know.
Yeah.
He thought it was Friday, and so they he thought they would only eat fish, but of course they would have been eating a Passover lamb. And there's lovely, fluffy Italian rolls, but they would have been eating unleavened bread, matzah, and it wouldn't look like that. I love Italian rolls, but that's not what they would have been eating. They're also, I always wonder why they're always on one side of the table. It
yeah.
looks like an Italian wedding, you know, and when they take the picture and the photographer comes around,
yeah.
That's not right. But the thing that bothers me the most is that Leonardo decided to paint each of the disciples and Jesus to look like someone who isn't Jewish, not a Mediterranean Jew. They all look quite not Jewish.
Mm.
And then the one person that he paints to look Jewish, and not even truly Jewish, but like a Nazi caricature with beady eyes and a hook nose, of course, that is, and dark hair, and that's Judas Iscariot. And so he uses the painting to take away the Jewishness of the disciples and Jesus, and then to almost villainize the one character that is it indeed the villain of the story, but he's the only one that looks like a caricature of a Jew.
Mm.
So it's tragic to me. I think that most of us think of the Last Supper not as a Last Seder, but the Last Supper, and then they lose what the painting, because they think of that. They lose what really was going on. I think it's great to really read the text and understand the Jewish backgrounds to it, and then get a new picture painted in our minds of what really happened.
You read the text, you can go to John's Gospel, and it's John 13 where it starts, where it says it was just before the Passover feast, and Jesus knew his time had come for him to leave this world and go to his Father, and having loved his own who are in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love, and the evening meal was being served, and he got up and washed their feet. I'm thinking that was not a typical Passover meal, and that would have maybe kind of changed the tone of the meal.
Yeah, it would have. In fact, it's kind of interesting because early in the Seder, in the Passover service, usually a servant will come in, or, you know, the person who works most like a servant at a Seder today is a mom with, you know, who's doing all the work. She'll come in with a special laver and have a ceremonial washing of the hands of the leader, any guests of honor, to show that they're ceremonially ready to lead a Passover meal. And that's what the disciples would have expected, that Jesus would have his fingertips ritually washed to start. But he doesn't do that. He takes this tradition and inverts it. And instead of having his fingertips washed by one of them, he goes around and washes the dirty, smelly feet of the disciples and teaches them to be servants. And it shows the authority that Jesus had as a teacher of the Bible to take a tradition and invert it and to give a lesson through that.
And this, I mean, as we go through the gospel account, it seems like there were lessons all the way through. I guess the question is, would the disciples have been, maybe at the time, would they have realized what was going on? Or say,
well,
hey,
would have been shocked with the foot washing. I'll tell you the other thing that Jesus did that was shocking to the disciples is generally, up until that point, the way the meal was eaten, you have ceremony, which includes two cups of wine, the first cup and the second cup. Then you have a meal. And when you finish the meal, what in ancient times they would do is they would take an olive-sized piece of lamb, set it aside, and then when you're done with your dessert, the last thing you would eat was that olive-sized piece of lamb after the meal. And that would be so that the lamb, which was central to the whole observance would be the last memory on your palate. And it's different at the Last Supper. Jesus doesn't take that piece of lamb. Instead, he takes a piece of matzah, and he says, "This is my body, which is given for you." And he substitutes the matzah for the lamb, and then he takes the cup after they had eaten the third cup, the cup of redemption, says, "This is the new covenant in my blood." And so, in essence, what he does is he takes that matzah and says, "This is a perfect object lesson for what I'm going to do. It's without leaven, and Jesus was without sin, and leaven being a typical symbol for sin. It's striped and it's pierced to keep it from rising, and he would be striped and pierced through for us for our redemption." So he takes that piece of matzah and substitutes it as that final piece of food, and then he takes the cup of redemption, the one that reminds us that we were redeemed from Egypt with the blood of a lamb, and he says, "No, now redemption with the new covenant will be through my blood." And it's symbolic, obviously, just as everything else on the table is symbolic. They understood that this is my body, just like the salt water wasn't real tears, and just like the parsley wasn't real life. Excuse me. See? Live radio.
Live radio. It is.
Are you there?
Yeah, we're still here.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right.
So he shows how those things were now fulfilled by him symbolically through his death. And so that's one of the innovations that she's had. What I find most interesting about Passover celebrations today is when the temple was destroyed and lambs were no longer sacrificed, Jewish people didn't know what to substitute for that last piece of lamb. And the early Jewish believers had followed Jesus' tradition, and I believe unwittingly, without even realizing it, the Jewish community today has replaced it with a little piece of matzah. Same thing. They call it the afikomen. The afikomen, they say, means dessert. Well, most Jewish study scholars recognize it means the one who has come. And it's a tradition that went from Jesus to his disciples, and now it's in traditional Judaism. They don't even know where it came from.
This is the Latin word that is used in church tradition, that this being Maundy, Thursday. Talk a little bit about that, maybe the mandate and what that really means.
It comes from the word command in Latin, and it was at the Last Supper that Jesus commanded his disciples to love one another and to serve one another. And so I think the tradition came to observe, in the church, to observe. I don't think there's any command to observe or not today, but the command to love one another certainly continues. And if people want to observe Maundy, Thursday, they can. If they want to not, that's fine too, as long as we obey the command to love one another.
The Passover meal was always, I think in John's Gospel it talks about it was night. Judas left sort of early. It was night. I mean, there's almost sort of a foreboding, I guess, as you read that and realize that this was. It was typical at night, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's always at night. That's why when Judas goes out and John says it was night, it's not just a mere fact of time and history. You know, he's not just saying, "Oh, it was night." He's communicating something that's so crucial in John's gospel, which is light versus darkness. Jesus is the light that comes into a dark world. And then Judas's act of betrayal of his master and to turn him over to those who want to kill him. When he goes out to do that, John says it was night. This is a very dark moment in the gospel.
And Judas actually would have been sitting near Jesus, right?
Yeah. The disciples had the great argument when they came in. Who's the greatest in the kingdom? I think they were trying to determine who gets the seat of honor. The youngest always gets to sit to the right of a leader. Back in the first century, and according to rabbinic tradition, the guest of honor sat to the left of the leader. And, I think that's why they were arguing who's the greatest, because they wanted this, who gets the seat of honor. And Jesus clues us in when they ask him, "Who will betray you?" He says, "The one to whom I offer the sop." That's when the sop refers to the ground up horseradish, which is dipped with matzah and everyone eats it. And he would have taken the horseradish and passed it first to the guest of honor, and then it would go around the table and everyone would take some. So we know that it's Judas that was seated in the seat of honor, amazingly. So, you know, Judas was the treasurer, maybe because he was from Judea. He was the one that they thought most highly of, finally, and they put him in that seat. Of course, he wasn't. He was the son of perdition, John calls him. So it just shows once again how man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart.
What would you recommend as we read these passages? Say if we, you know, read John's gospel, I mean, from 13 kind of to the end, you get his upper room discourse. What should we draw from there, maybe, if we're seeing it with fresh eyes?
Well, I think the main thing to draw from it is the centrality of Jesus as the Passover lamb. You know, later on, Paul writes, Messiah, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us. And that's in 1 Corinthians 5. And then also, Jesus himself in John 6 calls himself the bread of life. We think of that metaphor. But it is by drinking his blood and figuratively, and by eating his body, the bread, figuratively, that we experience life by believing in his death and resurrection, believing that he's the one that satisfies our hunger for God. And I think that's the great message of the Passover Seder as we study it.
Michael, we got a break coming up here in a moment. Just say a word about the Moody Bible Commentary before we take a break, because you're one of the general editors, co-editor of that. This is a great resource.
Oh, well, thank you. You're right. It is. I heard you say earlier that it's fairly large. You could use it as for one book, you could use it as a coffee table as well. But it's about 2,100 pages plus. It covers every verse of the Bible. It's written by the faculty of Moody Bible Institute, which is, I think, we have a strong tradition of teaching the Word faithfully. I was happy to not just be the editor, but participate in several books, as did my co-editor, writing several books. And then we had our fingerprints all over everything. We're sort of collaborators with everyone else. And it was a hard task, but I think the product is very helpful to a believer. You know, sometimes people get lost in the details in the Bible. This book kind of shows you how each paragraph flows. If there's a problem, difficulty to understand a verse, this commentary will try to address the difficulty. It also, if there's a current theological issue that people are dealing with, it will address it, so it's very up to date. And it's easy to read. It's not written for the person who is a graduate student. It's written for the everyday person who would like to understand the Bible better. I'm thrilled with the product, and I'm really grateful that people are using it.
We'll give a copy away at the end of the show. You can call now, 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH, to sign up for the drawing for that. And we'll talk more with Dr. Michael Rudelnik from Moody Bible Institute in just a moment.
Today.
How deep the Father's love for us, how vast beyond all measure that he should.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Staveman. A good Monday, Thursday to you. It's Holy Week, and today is a day when we remember Jesus' mandate. That's where Monday comes from, the Latin word for mandate. The mandate he gave his disciples and to all of us as his followers. It's a new command I give to you, that you love one another. And that occurred as he was sharing a meal together with his disciples in the upper room. We've been talking about it today. It was a Passover meal, and we're getting perspective during Holy Week and the time of Passover, which actually happens at sundown tomorrow night, with the professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute, Dr. Michael Rudelnik. We're glad to have him back with us. Michael is a Bible scholar specializing in the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish people, the land of Israel, and biblical prophecy. He's written several books. And he's also the co-editor of the Moody Bible Commentary. And we do have a copy of this one-volume commentary on the whole Bible. It's by the faculty of the Moody Bible Institute, the Moody Bible Commentary. We're going to give that away today. If you'd like to be in the drawing for that, and we'd love to have you just give us a call. Give Carissa your information. You can call us at 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. We'll enter you in the drawing for this great resource, the Moody Bible Commentary, as we talk more about this important week and the events of Jesus' final hours before the crucifixion. We've been talking about Passover then and now, and want to continue that conversation with Dr. Michael Radelnik. We're touching a little bit about how, you know, symbols have meanings. You mentioned in the Seder service the four cups of wine. It seems to me the last time we talked, there's something about that fourth cup, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't say it before when I was talking about the third cup. Let me just clarify. Okay. When I talked about the third cup being the new covenant cup, the cup, that cup was considered the cup of redemption. So how significant that Jesus would take that cup and say, this is the new covenant in my blood. Just as we were redeemed through the blood of a lamb, so the new covenant will be established, the blood of the Passover lamb, Jesus.
So just to clarify, in the order of the service, in other words, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jesus took the third cup, the cup after they had eaten. There are two cups before they eat. He took the cup after they had eaten and said, this is the new covenant in my blood. And the third cup, the cup after they had eaten, is called the cup of redemption. So then there's a fourth cup. And the fourth cup is called the cup of praise, and it refers to praise for the future messianic kingdom. Remember earlier we talked about Elijah. You go to the door, you see if Elijah's there, and if he's not, then you drink the fourth cup in anticipation of a future kingdom where the Messiah will come and reign, and there'll be a great messianic banquet, and that's what the fourth cup represents. And interestingly, Jesus at the Last Supper says of the fourth cup, I won't drink this again until I come into my Father's kingdom. And so he left that fourth cup standing. Remember, they drank the third cup. They sang a hymn, which is the Hallel or the praise psalms from Psalm 113 through 118, which are part of the Seder. And then when you would normally drink the fourth cup, he left it standing and said, I'm going to drink this one, but not now. When I return and I establish my kingdom, that's when I'll drink this cup with you. And, of course, when we have the Lord's Supper, what do? We eat the bread and drink the cup to show forth the Lord's death until he comes. And that's when we'll drink the fourth cup with him.
When Jesus appeared to his disciples, John records John 20, the breakfast by the Sea of Galilee. But would the disciples have known then, I mean, was there significance to maybe the mealtime or that just connection there? Did they understand at that point, do you think? I guess we're talking about that fourth cup. So that's not when he wouldn't have had a cup of wine then.
No, he said, when I enter into my Father's kingdom. They knew they were not yet in the kingdom when Jesus returned. In fact, we know this because right before his ascension, they said, are you going to now restore the kingdom to Israel? And he said, he didn't say, I'm not going to. He said, it's not for you to know the time. Yeah. And so they knew they weren't in the kingdom. And they still look forward with anticipation, as we do, when Messiah returns, establishes his kingdom, and then we'll drink that fourth cup with him.
Give us a sense of the climate, the atmosphere in that week as pilgrims are coming from literally all around the Middle East, right? They would come to Jerusalem for Passover?
Yeah, all around the entire diaspora. Jewish people are coming for the great festival. Jerusalem probably had about 100,000 people, according to the figures that we can see or the description that we see in Josephus. Josephus says it grew by 3 to 10 times as many people. So there might have been 300,000. There might have been 1 million people in Jerusalem, which is a very small city. So it was very crowded. And not only was it very crowded, but can you imagine some people would bring their own animals with them for sacrifice, although not everyone would. Likely that's why they had people serving in the temple, selling pure and spotless temple-approved animals. In fact, that's probably one of the things that what started out as a service to help the people in the temple, to provide a sacrifice for them that they could buy, turned into a business. For example, it was very hard to get your animal to pass muster. And if they said, no, it's not pure enough, it's not spotless enough, then you have to buy one that's already pre-approved. And, of course, if you have to buy one, then you need to use special temple currency to do it. So you've got to change your currency to temple currency. And then, of course, there's a charge for changing that. And this is why just before the Passover, the Lord Jesus cleansed the temple. You know, he said, you're turning my Father's house into a place of business. That's not the intention of providing a service for people. It was probably very crowded, lots of people, people coming to worship and celebrate and finding probably why the Lord Jesus had to make arrangements for that upper room on Mount Zion.
And would, if people brought their animals along, right, would they have you know, they just, I mean, was there a holding place? Would you, I mean, you sort of drop your livestock off?
It was just a little lamb, so it wasn't, wasn't a big deal.
Okay.
So, yeah, so you bring your puppy along, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Take him in, so.
But just, I would think the noise, I think for most of us, we just don't have any concept of what the sacrificial system would have been like in terms of the noise and the mess and everything.
Yeah. It's sometimes hard for us to fathom, you know, and then also how many sacrifices the priests had to offer, or at least supervise when people would offer them at the temple. It would have been, you know, a lot of scheduling, a lot of lines, people waiting to have their sacrifice offered so then they could go cook it and have a Passover meal with their family, or their group that they were going to, their community they were going to be with. It would have been quite crowded, quite busy. Long lines. It would have been not like what we think of. It's just a very quiet, peaceful time.
And, you know, help us to understand, I guess, the sacrificial system. I mean, you talked about, you know, Jesus, the perfect, sinless Lamb of God. But, you know, the blood of the Lamb as a important symbol during this time. I think people today probably wonder, well, why the emphasis on blood? What difference does that make?
Yeah, well, of course, the scriptures say without blood, there's no forgiveness. It says the life of the flesh is in the blood. I've given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. That's really talking about the general Passover, the general sacrificial system. The Passover lamb has its roots, of course, in the Passover, the original Passover. It was not really a sin offering so much as an offering to remember, a memorial offering, to remember that original Passover when God passed over judgment. And nevertheless, it that imagery from that first Passover lamb, that God passed over judgment when we applied the blood to the doorposts of our homes, in the same way, you know, when we apply the blood of the Messiah Jesus, who is pure and spotless, perfect, when we apply that blood to the doorposts of our hearts by faith, God then will pass over judgment. That's the symbolism that's there. And in fact, that's what 1 Peter seems to be referring to in chapter 1 when it describes the sacrifice of the Messiah for us. He says in verse 18, "Know that you are not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers, but with precious blood as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Messiah."
Hopefully we read those words with a new understanding as a result of this week and remembering. Would there have been festivals sort of associated with Passover? For example, I guess I shouldn't say the word festivals, but I mean the Romans choosing that time for crucifixion. I mean, was that something that was
Romans
ongoing?
Romans didn't need an excuse to crucify. They crucified year-round.
Okay.
That was not a special time for them. But, you know, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is mentioned in the Bible, is sort of united with Passover. So for 8 days, we don't eat leaven. Clean our houses of leaven, according to Exodus 13. We're supposed to clean our houses out. No leaven for a week. 8 days, you have the Passover memorial dinner at the first night. And then after that, a week of no leaven following that. And so the Feast of Unleavened Bread is linked with it. And it also starts the countdown right after Passover. It starts the countdown to the festival of Pentecost. You count 7 weeks, and then on the 50th day, you have Pentecost, or Shavuot in Hebrew.
Would people come in from the surrounding countryside, say from Galilee, for example, would they come to Jerusalem and stay for like those 8 days or longer?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they'd stay there, the first 2 days being high festival, and the last 2 days being high festival, the middle 4 days being intermediate days. Yes, the people would have stayed. They would have found lodging, stayed with relatives, done something like that, and celebrated Passover. Just as Jesus did, it appears that he was over in Bethany with the family of Lazarus.
Which was just outside the city, right?
Mm-hmm. Just east of the Mount of Olives.
So maybe just help us a little bit with geography. So would Jesus have come in and out? I mean, in and out of the city. Right?
Yeah, he would have come in to the city for celebration, which it's not that far. The challenge of Jerusalem actually is the hills, the mountains. I mean, when you walk down the Mount of Olives, it's pretty steep. And then you go down into the Kidron Valley, and then you come right back up into the city. And so it is the city of Jerusalem is built on a mountain. And so it's a friend of mine once was going to spend some time in Jerusalem, and he was looking for an apartment. And he said he wanted to find an apartment in Jerusalem where you didn't have to walk up and down on the hills. And I said, then go to Tel Aviv. Because Jerusalem's a mountain. It's up and down, all over the place.
And that would have been common, people finding place to stay, so they would have been in and out of surrounding cities and coming in every day. Yes.
For the celebration. Mm-hmm.
In a moment, I want to talk a little bit more about events that led to the crucifixion and just helping us understand that a bit more with Dr. Michael Rudelnik. He's professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute, and he's joining us today, giving us some understanding of Passover and this this week of reflection and remembrance. And we'll get some more insight from Dr. Michael Rudelnik in a moment. If you have a question, you can join us at 877-933-2484. Before the hour, talking today with Dr. Michael Rudelnik, professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute, and has a sought-after speaker and teacher, and he's teaching us today about Holy Week, about Passover, the Seder service. We're talking about the death of Christ, his sacrifice. You mentioned that we're talking a little bit about symbols have meaning, as the events of the next few hours went on, would those symbols come, and I guess maybe just your impression, would have disciples have figured that out? I mean, even as Jesus said, this is my body, this is my blood. But were there other symbols within the Passover Seder service that they might have sort of picked up on over the next, 36 hours or so?
Well, obviously the disciples understood that symbol, and what they did with it is quite significant about the matzah. There is a very early tradition that what they did is that early in the Passover meal, this is the early Messianic Jews, they would take a piece of matzah, break it in half, take half of it, wrap it in a linen napkin, hide it, and then they would bring it back at the third cup and use that piece of matzah to celebrate the Lord's table. That was the matzah that they used, and they called it the afikomen, from the Greek word, the one who has come, and that's what they used as the piece of matzah after they had eaten with the third cup, which is what the Lord Jesus used to establish the Lord's Supper. What's significant? So they obviously understood. I mean, look at that significance. It's broken. It's wrapped in, the piece of matzah is wrapped in linen, brought back at the third cup. Pretty significant symbolism. Well, after the destruction of the temple, when Jewish people no longer could offer a lamb sacrifice, it became traditional to replace that little piece of olive-sized lamb that a person would eat after the meal for their dessert, to replace it with a piece of matzah, and they even called it the afikomen. They even adopted the tradition of breaking the matzah, wrapping it in linen, and bringing it back then at the third cup. And every traditional Seder you go to, that's what they're doing. But they have no idea why. If you ask most Jewish studies scholars, what does afikomen mean? They don't realize it comes from the Greek word for the one who has come. Instead, they'll say, well, I think it means dessert. Well, no, it doesn't mean dessert. It means the one who has come, and it's a tradition. In fact, a number of really fine Jewish historians, like David Daub, who taught at Cambridge University in England, said, no, this tradition that's in the normal Seder, the typical traditional Seder, was actually taken from early Messianic Jews who understood the significance of Jesus' death and resurrection.
Are there ways that we might, with the friends and neighbors, coworkers who are Jewish, who might be, taking part in the Seder? I mean, are there some ways that we could, get into dialogue, or are there some questions we ought to ask?
Yeah, I think always a great way when you want to talk with your Jewish friends is to wish them a happy Passover, wish them a sweet Passover. You can say Chag Sameach or Chag Pesach Sameach, which is, a joyous Passover. That's a Hebrew greeting, or you can say Azisen Pesach, which is Yiddish, but another way you can say it, a sweet Passover. Or you could just say Happy Passover to your friends. I mean, you don't have to say it in Hebrew or Yiddish. And send them a Passover card, maybe. You can ask them about how their Seder was. You can ask them about what they learned. Were there any other new things that they learned this year at Passover? Any aspects? I always find the best way to talk to people is ask them questions. A second thing is to say, you know, I was listening to the radio. I heard this guy talk about a Messianic Jewish celebration of Passover. And I think always there are local congregations, Messianic congregations or whatnot, who are having Passover meals with Messiah as central to it. You, if you have a friend that's interested, you can always invite your friends to a Passover meal where the Messianic significance is being explained. So those are some ways. But always the best way, start by asking and listening.
Diane checked in listening in on Faith 1090 and just wanted to know if you could talk more about what Cup 1 and Cup 2 stood for in the
Yeah, the first cup is the cup of sanctification. It indicates sanctify means to set apart. It set apart the festival from the rest of the year. It starts the festival. The second cup is often called the cup of plagues because it's from this cup, the second cup before you drink it, you reduce the cup 10 drops of wine, one for each plague, and you recite the plagues. And so it's often called the cup of plagues. And it remembers also that God delivered us through plagues. And the third, of course, the cup of redemption, the fourth, the cup of praise for the kingdom.
And the message is that God delivers, and that's still the message today, isn't it?
Yeah, the cup of redemption, that's the key. God delivered us from Egypt through the blood of a lamb. He delivers us from sin through the blood of the Lamb, the Lord Jesus.
Can we talk a little bit about the Romans? Think about Pilate and Herod and those other sort of players in the story, if you will. They certainly were familiar with the Jewish festivals and rituals as they took place. Did they look at interacting with this? I mean, did they care? Do you think about their festival activities or?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Herod was present in Jerusalem because he came from a family of converts to Judaism. And as king in Galilee, he had to show his adherence and allegiance to Jewish observance, and so he came to Passover, a celebration in Jerusalem. Pilate was there. His seat of government was in Caesarea, north of Tel Aviv today. That's where the Roman seat of government was. But he came down, stayed by the Antonia Fortress to make sure that with all these people in the city and with all the Messianic expectation and all the excitement of Passover that things wouldn't get out of hand and there would be no rebellion against Rome. So that's why he was there. I don't think Pilate could care less about Judaism, about the Jewish people, or about Passover. He was just there to make sure that the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, prevailed.
Which gets you to think about that anticipation of Messiah, at the Passover, or Elijah, having that empty chair, that mm-hmm. the loss and the for those who follow Jesus, thinking, yes, could this be the Messiah? How devastating that crucifixion must have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, think about it. It was a very sad Passover for them, and of course, the sadness doesn't last because Sunday morning, they get word of the resurrection, and they're really excited, and the women tell the men, and of course the disciples come and look at the tomb, and word spread pretty fast that this one was resurrected. And of course, Paul tells us that in the 40 days that followed, that Jesus was seen by as many as 500 people. So pretty exciting. But it must have been a pretty disappointing time and sad time. I don't think disappointing is a good word. I think it was a devastating sadness for those who had hoped that he would be the one to deliver Israel. Just as the disciples in Luke 24, we had hoped, they said to Jesus, not knowing who they were talking to, that he would be the one to deliver Israel.
Well, let's talk about Luke 24 as I had my Bible open to that. What would have Jesus told those disciples? Because he said he opened up the scriptures to them. And so they all point to me.
Yeah. I wrote a whole book about that. Yeah. I think there are a lot of people today who are saying that the Hebrew scriptures don't point to the Messiah, that if they do, they do it indirectly. And so one of the key passages that I used in the book, The Messianic Hope, is to show that indeed Jesus and the disciples all believed that the Hebrew Bible was messianic. And when you read the Hebrew Bible itself, it believes it's messianic. In fact, that's its message. And so he would have started, I think, with Genesis, pointing to the seed that would crush the head of the serpent and work his way to that very same seed who would bless the nations, who would be the lion of the tribe of Judah, reigning over Israel, who would be the prophet like Moses in Deuteronomy 18. It's described like that. And then continue on to the prophets and all that they had to say about Messiah, who would, according to Isaiah 53, be a suffering servant, die on behalf of the people, and then that he would be raised from the dead and ascend into glory, just as Psalm 16 and Psalm 110 teach, seated at the right hand of the Father, awaiting his kingdom. And so for there's so many passages that Jesus would have taught them. Truthfully, I once heard a guy teach that none of these passages were messianic, and a student said to him, but Jesus did, and he didn't say Jesus, he said, Peter seems to think they're messianic in the book of Acts, and the professor said, well, I don't agree with Peter's interpretive principles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's probably a risky position, but
so they came to me, they said, what do you think? I said, well, I'd go with Peter's a hermeneutics or interpretation professor, Jesus. I think he seemed to teach him something. So,
it's always good to, I guess, know which side you come down on. it does say, because Jesus said, did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? Was there an understanding of the Messiah that would suffer?
Well, most Jewish people in the first century actually were looking just for a reigning Messiah. But there was, Judaism was not uniform in the first century. It was very sectarian. There were various groups, and there was some segments within Judaism, or at least one segment, that was looking for a suffering Messiah. So there was this sense that Messiah had to suffer, but it was not the dominant view among the different sects of Judaism.
Tell me the name of the book again, as you're talking about sort of connecting the Old Testament with the New.
It's called The Messianic Hope. Is the Hebrew Bible really messianic, and it's published by B&H.
Messianic Hope.
Yep.
Our time's just about gone, Michael, but I just you've got a moment, if there's a final thought you want to leave with us, just about how we can, I think, better understand the Jewish roots of our faith and
Say never forget to keep reading. You can't read the Last Supper without going through and reading the Exodus story and seeing the background to it. Don't cut off the Bible from the Hebrew Bible. It's not just the New Testament. It's one whole Bible. It links up. So I really want to encourage you to read that and to enjoy that Jesus and the disciples were Jewish, and that there are Jewish people who follow Jesus today who still can experience, and so all people can experience that Jewish root. And so I want to encourage people, keep reading, keep studying, and keep recognizing that Jesus is the Messiah of Israel first, and that's why he can be the Messiah of the whole world.
And that message is still true today, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Over all these years.
Yes. Yep.
Would a modern Israeli, would they be... looking at this week, any different? I mean, just as
it's one of the main, across the world, the number one celebration of holidays that Jewish people have is Passover. And so, everyone's celebrating Passover, everyone's with family. It's a great season. My great concern is so many Jewish people don't understand one of the key psalms that we recite at a Passover Seder. It says in Psalm 118, that the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing, and it's marvelous in our eyes. And I'm hoping that many, many Gentile followers of Jesus will point their Jewish friends to the stone which the builders rejected.
Good insight, as always, from Dr. Michael Rydelnik, professor of Jewish studies at the Moody Bible Institute. You can find out more about him and his work and writing on his website, michaelrydelnik.org. And if you missed part of today's program or want to pass it on to a friend, you can go to our website, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page for the audio archive.